We have Attorney General Alan Wilson. How are you doing today, Attorney General?
I'm doing great. It's good to be back on your show again.
It's good to have you back. You know, I was anxiously looking for your updates, and I know you tweeted out stuff while you were up there. So just in a nutshell, how was it to be the state's attorney general that got the golden ticket to the Supreme Court?
Well, it was the event of a lifetime. It was an opportunity that I'll never forget, and I can tell you that I was truly humbled and honored to represent our state in court that day. It was truly amazing. This is going to be remembered and hallmarked as one of the most prolific and profound Supreme Court cases in our nation's history, and it is probably the most important case to be heard by this court in a generation or two.
And you know, one of the things that I find amazing is President Obama has been coming out and talking about judicial activism.
Yeah, the irony, or the hypocrisy, rather.
Right.
The president's certainly entitled to his opinion, and I respect everyone's opinion, but, my opinion is that, you know, when the court rules against you, it's judicial activism. When the court rules for you, it's, you know, they're upholding the Constitution. Both sides do it, both sides say it. My measuring stick for when the court is being an activist court is when they, is what the measuring stick I use is the actual Constitution itself. Reasonable people can disagree as to what the wording of the Constitution says, but when you look at the history of our country, never before has a Congress compelled an individual to engage in an activity for the sole purpose of then regulating them. Others have tried to draw similarities in other Supreme Court cases, such as Wicker v. Filburn and Gonzalez v. Raich, which dealt with the homegrown medical marijuana as well as the homegrown wheat cases, and saying that Congress could tell you what to do with your own homegrown wheat or marijuana if it was grown for personal use. Well, the difference in those cases and this case is that you were choosing to engage in an activity that, when done in the aggregate, if everyone did it, would affect interstate commerce. Here, they're regulating inactivity. They're saying we're going to force you to do something so that we can then regulate whatever it is you're doing. And you can't do that. You can't compel someone to create a commercial act.
I understand, but you know, one of the things that I was thinking about, Alan, is were you surprised by the activity, the liveliness of this whole act?
The
judges, the Supreme Court justices, and the back and forth and everything, were you surprised by it?
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, you know, I thought the court was very well briefed on the issue. I mean, obviously some justices wore their personal opinions very clearly on their sleeve. Others were a little more guarded and sometimes gave evidence as to what their true thoughts were by how they asked questions. But the back and forth and the way they engaged the counsel at the table was to be expected.
And what about the day that they actually took the break? Wasn't that unusual?
The break?
Didn't they take a 5 or 10 minute break because things had been kind of intense?
No. That was during the day of the mandate. That was on Tuesday, and each side had an hour of argument. And when you're sitting in the Supreme Court, there's about 300 to 400 people in that room, and it's not a very big room. It's very grand. It's very tall. The ceilings are 50 feet tall, but it's not a lot of floor space. And so we're all crammed in there, shoulder to shoulder. It's almost like Christmas Eve, church service. Everyone shows up that one time a year, and you're just crammed in there. And we had been sitting still, silent for an hour with no way to, move around, and packed in tightly. And so the Chief Justice allowed everyone to stand up for about 2 minutes to stretch their legs and to kind of move their arms around. And then we all sat back down and went into the second hour of argument. So I thought that was just the Chief Justice recognizing that, I think he recognized that the court wanted to get comfortable and stretch their legs, and probably all the listeners in the room wanted to do the same.
Okay. Well, I just thought they said that was pretty unusual. Now, when you came out of court with all the people for and against. What did you think about the crowds outside?
Well, and I will come back to that question. The follow-up, what you just said, someone may have said that was unusual, but remember, this is the first time the court has allowed that much argument in 45 years. So this is an unusual case to begin with.
Oh, okay.
And back to the question you had just asked is that, I mean, it was very exciting. There were probably about 1,000 people out in front of the Supreme Court. There were protesters on both sides. Everyone was fairly respectful on both sides. I didn't see anything violent go down. I didn't see anything, you know, unseemly happen. They had a large media pool. There were probably, you know, 40 to 50 media outlets represented there. They had a scrum off to the side with media and cameras, and we would walk down the Supreme Court steps down to the sidewalks. I mean, that we would be in a sea of people, and there would probably be 50 or 60 cameras around us as we gave interviews on what we had just observed. The security was very, very high. Like I said, this case is, you know, close to unprecedented in the kind of activity that it saw. And so it was very packed. In fact, there were people out the night before. You know, they have reserved seating for Supreme Court bar admittees,
mm-hmm.
and there were people camping out overnight. These are lawyers who would get there, you know, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning just to get an opportunity to sit in the courtroom.
It was kind of like when they were promoting the new iPad that came out, right?
You would have thought they were selling iPads inside the Supreme Court. that is a good analogy. But you're right. And there were people, I mean, the opportunity to be able to get into this courtroom, it was very hard to get in there if you didn't already have a reserved seat or if you weren't really, or if you weren't admitted to practice before the Supreme Court. It is very difficult to get in there. And that's why I was so honored to be able to sit through 3 days and 4 separate arguments of this historic law.
Why was that, Alan, that you got to be there all 3 days?
Well, I sat on the executive committee of the 26 states that brought this lawsuit. The executive committee hired the attorneys. We met periodically. Other attorneys general got to get in there because of their ability to sit before the practice before the Supreme Court, but they gave the executive committee passes for all 3 days, and I was one of 6 attorneys general of the plaintiffs that were on that committee. So we were sitting in there. I figured we're the one that brought the lawsuit, we're the one that hired the lawyers, we're the plaintiffs, and they felt that we ought to be able to sit in there, so they gave us those seats.
How did you feel that the attorneys for the 26 states did?
Oh, listen, Paul Clement, who we hired, and then, of course, the National Federation of Independent Business was represented by a guy by the name of Michael Carvin. Both of them did great. I have to tell you about Paul Clement. Ironically enough, he was on Law Review with President Obama at Harvard. They were 1 year apart, and he served there, and then he clerked for the Supreme Court. Then he was Deputy U.S. Solicitor General, and then under Bush he was the Solicitor General, which is the person tasked with representing the government in all Supreme Court cases. After representing the Supreme Court, representing the government as Solicitor General, he went into private practice, and this term alone has argued, or will argue, a total of 7 Supreme Court cases in 1 Supreme Court term. Very few people get to argue 7 Supreme Court cases in a lifetime. He's doing it in 1 term. He is very prolific in the court, and I have no doubt, Ann, that one day I believe he will be on the court. If not the Supreme Court, he will certainly be a high-ranking judge.
Well, now, he's the one that you have also hired on the immigration, is that correct?
Well, yes. He's working with us on voter ID, and he is representing Arizona on the immigration lawsuit, which we ultimately will have the same fate as Arizona. So I guess by relationship, he is representing our interest on immigration as well. But I've hired him to represent South Carolina on the photo ID law.
I don't suppose he's cheap, is he?
No, he's not cheap. But when you're arguing it, when you have a Supreme Court practice, there are very few. It's an elite bar. Very few have the aptitude or the ability to do it. And those that do, it is very difficult to function at that level of our court system and do it in a way that is competent and sound. And with the issues that we're dealing with, it is so important that we have the best representation, because if we don't win or if we don't do well, it could have adverse impacts on our state.
Absolutely. I only made that comment because I had Mike Pitts on, Representative Mike Pitts on yesterday, and he said that y'all had conversations because he is over the budget for your office.
Well, actually, he, as it relates to the health care lawsuit, you know, he charged the 26 states, you know, it was I think, a $250,000 bill. It was a flat fee. South Carolina's portion of it was $20,000. Which is very cheap, considering other firms that would have cost us hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Absolutely.
So actually, he did this on a flat rate, and that saved the state an incredible amount of money.
Absolutely, that's phenomenal. $20,000 to go up against the Supreme Court—that's pretty good, Alan.
That was our share. Yeah, I know.
So you were saving us money there.
I think so, and of course, you know, I've caught heat from folks who disagree with our position on the health care, and they say that I'm wasting money filing frivolous lawsuits, which, because we're in the Supreme Court, means it's not frivolous. But I say to folks, you know, how expensive is it to not contest this law? I mean, what would it cost us to not try to knock this law down? And the way I look at it is, it's going to cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars over the years to implement Obamacare and the onerous mandates that follow it, and the Medicaid expansion and all the other provisions of the law. And so the way I look at it is, $20,000 is a very small investment to pay on protecting us from having to spend hundreds of millions of dollars down the road.
Absolutely. Well, what was your, at the end when you walked out, I know they say nobody can predict what the Supreme Court is going to do, but how did you feel?
Well, I felt very good, first for this reason. 2.5 years ago, when this law was being debated in the halls of Congress, and I remember Speaker Pelosi being asked the question, is this constitutional? Do y'all have the power to do this? And she looked indignantly at the reporter and said, are you kidding me? Are you serious? And other talking heads throughout academia around the law schools in this country, you know, called the people who were opposing this health care law a bunch of wing nuts. They said that we had no legal standing, that there was no law, that we had no grasp of the law, and all the concerns that we raised, they criticized and ridiculed us. And the very questions that were asked by all the justices in the court that asked questions was the same questions that were asked 2 years ago. And I felt very happy to know that I along with many others who were very upset about this law when it was passed, were vindicated by the court's questioning. The fact that when you make it to the United States Supreme Court, your grievance is not frivolous. And when the questions you raised were questions that the justices and even the courts that upheld the law at the appellate level and the district level raised the same concerns and said, this is unprecedented, this has never happened before, I felt vindicated and very happy. That was the first issue. The second issue was, where will the court go from here? I am loath to predict what the Supreme Court will do, but I can say this, based on the questions I heard, especially by the more moderate swing voters in the court, such as Justice Kennedy, that there was grave concerns about the far-reaching implications and ramifications that this court will cause if it upholds this law. And those concerns were shared by some of the justices. And the four conservative justices on the court, who are a strict constructionist and adhere strictly to the writing of the Constitution, all seem to be solid on where they stood on the mandate, and Justice Kennedy seemed to have grave concerns about it, which leads me to believe that the mandate is in trouble. That doesn't mean, I'm not predicting that it'll get struck down, but I think it's in trouble.
So who do you think's going to write the brief?
Well, you know, if the Chief Justice is in the majority, you know, he will reserve that right to himself. However, he could always delegate that to the last person to come on, such as Justice Kennedy. You know, I don't know who will write the brief, but obviously the senior justice in the majority will probably get the lock on that, and I imagine that would be most likely John Roberts, unless he defers to someone like Kennedy.
Mm. Well, I know that you are thrilled to have been able to be there and be part of that, and I guess you'll be going back to the Supreme Court when the voter ID comes up.
Well, if we get that far, we have filed a complaint against the Justice Department because the Supreme Court has already upheld a similar law in Indiana. I don't see why we need to go back to the Supreme Court again on the same issue. But We have filed a complaint against Justice. We're waiting on their reply. Immigration will be going forward next month with the state of Arizona. I intend to go hear those arguments as well, because that will have a direct impact on South Carolina's law, a lawsuit on immigration. So there's a very strong likelihood that before I leave this job, I will be back in the Supreme Court on behalf of South Carolina again.
Well, State's Attorney Alan Wilson, thanks so much for calling us this morning and filling us in on your exciting adventure.
I'm always honored to be on your show and talk with you and your listeners and to inform you all on what we're doing. And as always, call me if I can ever be of service to you.
Thank you so much, Alan. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.